For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
So, welcome everyone. I'm Tygon Layton, teacher here at Ancient Dragon Zen Gate. Welcome to all the people who are here for the first time. There are flyers out front, and you can look at ancientdragon.org to find out about our schedule and if you want to come back for meditation. But I'm here tonight to introduce our guest teacher, Joanna Macy. I'm so delighted to have you in Chicago. Joanna's an old friend and a mentor of mine. I took a course with her, gosh, it's almost 25 years ago.
I think exactly
25 years ago. I barely can be so precise. Anyway, I took a great, wonderful course with her in graduate school on nonviolence and Gandhi, and then worked with her in the Nuclear Guardianship Project, and she's been a long-time mentor and friend and an inspiration to me, so I'm really happy to have her here in Chicago. Welcome, everyone, and Joanna, thank you for being here.
I'm very happy to be here. Thank you, and with this Ancient Dragon Zen Gate. I lost my watch yesterday.
Which is funny, because you're going to be talking about time tonight, right?
I know, I think maybe that's and different kinds of time. So I think that maybe that's not surprising. My friendship with Tygon has been interlaced with questions about time and the application of them. His book, of the Bodhisattva Archetypes, Faces of Compassion, that was the original title, I loved very much, derived great benefit from, as well, of course, as his translations of Dogen. And so this also, and when I was taking a retreat last year of 3 months at home, devoted to connecting with the future beings, that I'm finding ways that we could enlarge our temporal context, our sense of the breadth of the time we're living in, so that it could, our lives could feel relevant to those who are coming after us, the following generations. I woke up one morning with thoughts of celestial bodhisattva Kshitigarbha, also known as Jizo, who I think is on the altar.
No, he's in there's a big picture of him in the kitchen.
Oh. That's right, he's not there.
He's at
phone. I picked up the phone and from my home in Berkeley, California, I called Tygon. And he was advising me and shoring me up and giving ideas. Let me begin with telling you of a story that I loved very much about how the Huayan scriptures came to China. And as you may know, and this I read in Garma C.C. Chan's book, Visions of Totality, these were wonderful, rich scriptures. And the Empress of China was very interested in getting them translated. And she brought, supported the monastery where the monks were translating them, and is said to have brought them food every day. And they were under the leadership of the great scholar Fa Zhang, and he discoursed most beautifully on the radical interdependence of all phenomena. And through space and time, taking very seriously the key central doctrine of the Lord Buddha, of the dependent co-arising of all things, and lifting that up and holding it and expanding it to become a kind of holographic view of the universe. And at the end, when the scriptures were translated, she said to Fatsang, it is so wonderful that we have these discourses now for our elucidation, but you know, on the interdependence of all things. But the Buddha himself said that even better than concepts were direct sensory perception of things. Is there not a way, O learned scholar, said the Empress, that you could display what this is about in a way that I could apprehend it with my senses? And he said, well, Your Royal Highness, I could do that if you give me a room in your palace in a couple of days. And so 2 days later, they met, and he escorted her to this room. And in the center of the room, he had placed a Buddha Rupa, a little statue of the Buddha, with a candle beside it. And all over the room, on every side, on the ceiling, on the floor, in the corners as well, were mirrors. And you can see what that would display there, so they could see reflections, catching reflections back and forth, and Buddhas receding into the distance on all sides, all of them illumined by candles, of the entire universe were made of Buddhas. And she clapped her hands and said, how wonderful. Now I can apprehend with my senses how this teaching can be really imagined. And now, Fatsang, a great scholar, could you do this for me in relation to time? Could you show me the interdependence, the dependent co-arising of past, present, and future in the same, with an equally graphic way? And Fatsang Well said, well, that'd be harder. I think that the means are not in hand for that. And he managed to excuse himself from that, but he did not say it was impossible. Well, I thought of that. His evocation of this holographic nature of the universe, of reality itself, and of Fatsang's assurance that that could allow us to see how past, present, and future could display their interrelatedness, their mutual unfolding. I particularly thought of that when I began to be obsessed more and more about the question of the containment of radioactive materials, like nuclear waste. Though nuclear waste is, that the term waste doesn't quite capture it, because it is the radioactive materials that are generated at every stage of the fuel cycle of making nuclear power generation and nuclear weapons, from the milling and the mining of the uranium and the enrichment of the uranium every Shinto manufacturer of the pellets to go in the zirconium rods to make the reactors. Same process we need for the nuclear warheads and the plutonium pits. At every single stage, there was generation of just astronomical amounts of radioactive materials of great toxicity. And after every glove and booty and truck that is equally contaminated. So, having been by some trick of fate that I didn't fully understand myself, having become arrested by this, I couldn't leave it alone, and I wasn't trained. I'm not trained as a nuclear engineer, physicist, but I couldn't get away from, you know what it was? It was when I started the work with despair work, despair and empowerment. I got a letter from a naval officer out of the blue, and he wanted me to know that because this was for him a source of nightmare, source of anguish, knowing that how much we had fabricated and how hot, thermally hot, radioactively hot they remained for virtually forever. So when I found that I couldn't run away from this question, and I began to question and talk and travel to people I could talk to, both in government and industry, in scientists and plant managers and engineers, I couldn't find people who could tell me how this was going to be contained for the long term. The longest I could find was 50 to 100 years that both industry and government took responsibility for containing this. Even when they put it in the ground, the containers in which it put were not capable of containing the radioactivity without embrittling and leaking it for more than 50 to 100 years. So I thought, we need to be able to think in bigger time spans. We're generating something that shows that our karma now, the consequences of our actions, extend into geological time periods. Well, if the consequences of our actions, often taken under pressure of profit-seeking and bureaucratic deadlines in industry and political expediency in industry and government. These are, people are in a hurry, they're making these decisions. I talked to some of them, and who is supposed to be regulating. And the idea of even thinking about containing them longer than that, or how to pass on the knowledge of what it was. So I began thinking about the Empress of China and Vatsan. And I began thinking about, now we do have something that can show us that we, in a split second of choice, under pressure, we can do an action that can have cripple and kill for literally millions of years. Actually, billions of years in the case of depleted uranium. So I thought, well then who can I ask? Well, I can't think about this alone. So I invited some friends to join me And this group included a cosmologist, that was Brian Swim, and a nuclear engineer. And it was very important to have a broad band of brains, you know, so I had a kindergarten teacher, a dancer, an environmental lawyer, a poet. And we began to look at what this radioactive material is and how it can, what are the regulations, how can we understand what happens. And we found this so challenging, both on the mental level, that and on the psychic and emotional level, because it made us scared and sad, that we built in spiritual practice into it. And we built in a spiritual practice that would help us link with the future generations. Because it was clear that here, as in other areas, like the creation of genetically modified organisms and pumping them into foods and animals and things, this is playing kind of loose and high, wide, and handsome with future generations. So again, found ourselves in service to future generations and wanting to enlarge our sense of relationship to them. I think it was also that when I didn't find people who had an answer among the current government industry and scientific establishment, I thought, well, the people who would know what they want us to are the people who live in the future. And I wanted to consult them. But I didn't know how, particularly given our notion of what time is. I was perfectly aware, having most of my education, elementary and secondary education, in a French lycée, which was extremely Cartesian and logical in its approach, I was perfectly aware that mainstream thinking sees time as going in one direction, from past to future. And we're right here in a little present moment. You see this line here? I'd like you to see it. And that in this one way, this dominant view of time as sequential, the past over here is gone, over, finished, forever. And the future remains an abstraction. You never really get to it. You're sort of here in this little box of the present. So I thought, well, how do I consult the future beings? I began reading mystics and poets and some philosophers who were experimenting and with opining that that sequential one-way view of time is useful. It keeps everything from happening all at once. It's tied to our kind of consciousness, and there are other forms of experiencing time. And so as I played around with that, and especially with my group, the Nuclear Guardianship Group, we could picture, instead of the present being on this line of past to future, with the ancestors here and the future ones out there, future generations, this present is here and the past and future surround them. Can you picture that? So they're not forever gone, overdone, finished, out there, or a pure abstraction, but the past generations and the future generations are like around us, cycling around us. And our consciousness at times can expand a little bit through an into a slightly altered state of consciousness through meditation and other exercises of the mind and other substances as well, and other kinds of breathing, as Stanislav Grof has found with his holotropic breathing. He's found some of that same thing, that they could hold it as the past and future encircling us, which made us somehow conceptually more comfortable to imagine that you're contacting the, or in the presence of the future generations. A scientist helped in this, a wonderful scientist, as we were laboring. You see, we were laboring both with stretching our consciousness and learning data. And then we knew that if we had to really learn the data about regulations, the nature of this, and we stopped calling it radioactive remains because we did so many role plays with the future generations that we picked up a language from them, and we began to call it the poison fire. And this has actually spread. The first world uranium hearing in Europe was called as looking together at the poison fire. But that came from the future beings, at least in terms of our hanging out with them and pretending to speak, you know, like getting into psychodrama with the future ones. So there's a scientist I started to mention who we began to feel strengthened by this. So one was a scientist named Sister Rosalie Bertell. Did you ever meet her?
I never met her. You know, she passed away a couple months ago.
Earlier this month.
Okay.
Just a couple of weeks ago. It was a great loss. This is a remarkable woman. She was a Catholic nun who became a remarkable a scientist around radioactive emissions, and she was an expert witness at many a trial of nuclear activists, and she had measured the incidence of cancers and leukemias and miscarriages and birth deformities and stillbirths, even around reactors that were having an accident. That just, but you know, all reactors emit and their emissions come on. But she is very, very, and I saw her again at the trial in Chernobyl. What she said, every being who will ever live on Earth is here now. Every being who will ever live on Earth is here now. Where? In our ovaries and in our gonads and in our DNA. And the decisions we make now about radioactivity or about, let's say, GMOs too and other forms and other kinds of playing high, wide, and handsome with natural phenomena have everything to do whether with future beings, if they're born sound of mind and body. But it also is the sense that what we subject ourselves to in terms of radiation now will have an effect long into the future. And that is the case now around Chernobyl, that there are, which I'm quite directly connected to myself, with people living there and projects we've undertaken to supply them with radiation monitors. But their children, who weren't even born at the time of the Chernobyl disaster, are not, to a significant extent, are not being able to conceive. So, how do I want to portray this to you? I'd like to say what I learned about what's happening that struck me, because my search for and the with this work in the nuclear guardianship, as we saw how we could begin more and more to open to the presence, and I'm going to get in a minute to the Buddha self of that, and the, along with Fatsan. But what we learned about this, our experience of time in the Western world, in mainstream society, and I can sort of see if I can say that in a couple of sentences. I learned a great deal from the psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton, who wrote a book called The Broken Connection. And he's a psychiatrist who studied the effects of the nuclear bombs on the population of Japan, particularly Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And he's the one who coined the term psychic numbing. And that there was an event of such mega death, so traumatizing, such a deep collective trauma, that there was an enduring shock effect to the psyche that he called psychic numbing. And then, so he thought that applied to the victims of the United States' use of nuclear weapons on the Japanese. But then he decided that the same symptoms he could find in the country that had dropped the bombs, and that in the United States as well, there was widespread psychic numbing, that there was stuff we didn't like to look at. And maybe we were blocked, as the Japanese would not be blocked, by a sense of guilt. We didn't like to look at that. And that, not only that, but that the megadeath brought by nuclear weapons, like nuclear winter, that this could end up killing most life on Earth, most complex life forms with a nuclear winter. Then this prospect of nuclear war had an effect on the psyche, on the imagination, the capacity to imagine that you, your species, you as a species, could continue. There was a loss of certainty. It used to be, we found whatever happens, humans will go on. Well, that was, he determined, was lost or crippled, damaged. And he said, and this is in his book, The Broken Connection, that there's a sense of radical biological severance, I should put in quotes, radical biological severance between the generations, between us and the generations of the future, as well as, and then if you've lost a sense of the future, interestingly enough, it has a symmetrical effect, and you kind of lose a sense of being connected to the ancestors. If you're kind of isolated in the present moment. Well, that might explain why we were so busy trashing the future. Thought I, and others, that we are using up everything just as fast as we can, using up all the oil, using up all the everything, all the precious metals, so that there's real doubt as to whether after this civilization fails, there could be a civilization that would be able to have the minerals that we would require for another civilization. So, this is looking. I would like to tell you what built our. Oh, and just the other thing about the kind of time we're living in is the broken connection with the past and future generations, and then in this little space of the future, speeding up like on a squirrel cage, on a hamster wheel, everything going faster and faster and faster. And that certainly could be explained by our technology, which works to have everything move with greater speed, greater efficiency, which means greater speed. So the time is passing now so fast in nanoseconds that for the first time in our planetary journey as humans, in the human journey, we are measuring time faster than we can sense it biologically. And this is also because of market forces in a growth economy. So when we're kind of trapped in this speedy world, cut off from past and future, how can we regain a sense of a time that can relate us to Earth, to each other, through time, to the past, to the future ones, and give us hope for continuing. So there's a lot of things we found ourselves doing in the Nuclear Guardianship Project, in addition to developing a guardianship ethic, that we don't make things and abandon toxic materials, put them in the hands of the future generations without supplying the means for controlling and keeping them out of the biosphere. So one was to begin to practice. So these are really heartening ways that we've been finding for befriending our world, befriending time, opening ourselves to time. Us in this hurried society, us in this acceleration of time, us in a society making things that can cripple and kill for so many, for millions of years, how can we open our mind? Okay, so the first one is the new cosmologies. And in the last couple of generations, standing strong in that is theologian, or he called himself geologian, Thomas Berry, a passionist priest who invited us to see our participation in the unfolding story of the universe from the beginning of time, from the beginning of what he calls the primal flaring forth. So you could take your hand right now, look at your hand, and you could do a little meditation on it. And you could see, as a meditation object, looking at your hand, becoming aware that every particle in every atom, in every molecule, in every cell of this hand goes back to the spinning of the galaxies, the elements being created 13 billion years ago. You see the age. This wasn't just born with you. Then you reflect on how this hand was a fin once in the mother seas where life took form. Where you see that every adventure since then you could see as shaping that hand. Crawling up on the dry land when the waters receded. Learning to reach, to grasp, to climb, chipping rocks, weaving reeds into baskets, planting seeds, making fire, all of that in this hand. So to know your place in time or know the drama of time which has brought you to this moment, this fleeting moment, with so many more to follow, you're invited to encourage your poetic mind and your moral imagination to see your relatedness. Thich Nhat Hanh does this in a poem, and maybe that'll be much more quickly entering your psyche than the hand meditation. But I invite you to return to the hand meditation. Zen master from Vietnam, Thich Nhat Hanh, writes a poem of this talking to you. Imagine him speaking this to you, and in so doing, where's my water?
Right here.
In so doing, he is telling you, inviting you to entertain seriously the immensity of time that is in you. Being rock, being gas, being mist, being mind, being the mesons traveling among galaxies with the speed of light, you have come here, my beloved ones. Your eyes shine so beautiful and deep. You have taken the path traced for you by both the non-beginning and the never-ending. On your way here, you have gone through millions of births and deaths. Innumerable times, you have been transformed into firestorms in outer space. You have used your own body to measure the age of the mountains and rivers. You have manifested yourself as trees, as grass, as butterflies, as single-celled beings, and as chrysanthemums. The eyes with which you look at me now and your smile invite me into the game whose beginning no one knows, the game of hide and seek. Oh, green caterpillar, you are solemnly using your body to measure the length of the rose branch that grew last summer. Everyone says that you, my dear one, were just born this spring. But tell me, how long have you been around? Oh, caterpillar suns, moons, and stars flow out each time I exhale. Who knows that the infinitely larger must be found in your tiny body? So he is suggesting in this poem that kind of holographic effect of the big, the large being contained in the small, the whole being held in the part that is evoked not only in holography but in the Huayan Buddhism that the Empress was getting translated for her. So Dogen, of course, wonderfully, and this is, I'm so grateful to Taigen for helping me see in a number of ways how Dogen asks us, expects us, supports us in opening up our experience of time so that our being in the present moment can also include what has gone before and what will come after, can include the three times. A little bit like William Blake, the poet, finding eternity in an hour and what was something?
Universe in a grain of sand.
Yeah. That this, the large and this capacity to, instead of just being strung out on this line, one-way arrow of time, that its fold, time can fold in on itself, and that we can access that relationship to the future and the past through a Dharma practice. He So for the person, the enlightenment of all things returns to the person in Zazen. And then that person and all the other beings come together in that moment and intimately and imperceptibly assist each other. So you go into a moment of such presence, such a keenness of presence in the practice, that you're there because you're entering Buddha Mudra. The posture of your body as you sit there, and then you are there with the Lord Buddha. And you are there with all the other beings of this phenomenal world. And in that experience, whether it's also, because the earth also are included, earth, grasses and trees, fences and walls, tiles, pebbles, all things in the Dharma realm in 10 directions carry out the Buddha work. Also the benefit of wind and water movement imperceptibly helped by the wondrous and incomprehensible influence of the Buddha to actualize enlightenment in him. So for somebody who's been worried about, and the numbers of us are growing, who's going to remember and how are we going to take care of the future when we're creating such literal mountains of radioactive waste, this capacity to open to the time so that we, and find a way that we won't dismiss it, that we won't we find both the find the heart, a connection with the beings that gives us a sense of desire and heart and appetite. So this is in a poem that I think this conveys me, conveys this. I wrote this as a prayer to the future beings that came out of this kind of preoccupation. You live inside us, beings of the future. So that's just pretty much what Sister Rose Lieber tells you. In the spiral ribbons of our cells, you are here. In our rage for the burning forests, the poisoned fields, the oil-drowned seals, you are here. You beat in our hearts through late-night meetings. You accompany us to clear cuts and toxic dumps in the halls of the lawmakers. It is you who drive our dogged labors to save what is left. Oh, you who will walk this earth when we are gone, stir us awake. Behold through our eyes the beauty of this world. Let us feel your breath in our lungs, your cry in our throat. Let us see you in the poor, the homeless, the sick. Haunt us with your hunger, hound us with your claims, that we may honor the life that links us. You have as yet no faces we can see, no names we can say, but we need only hold you in our mind, and you teach us patience. You attune us to measures of time where healing can happen, where soil and souls can mend. You reveal courage within us we had not suspected, love we had not owned. Oh, you who come after, help us remember, we are your ancestors. Fill us with gladness for the work that must be done. I have been heartened to see how there are societies, there are people who build in, even in today's world, even with all the hurry and haste and acceleration of time that is created with a 21st century living and the industrial growth society and the striving for rapid gaining of profits and market share, that there are those who know how to have developed practices. And one, of course, is helpful are the Haudenosaunee Native Americans. And I think this goes beyond the Haudenosaunee, like the Iroquois, it's the Six Nation Confederacy. Every meeting, every council meeting, to today, they invoke what they call the words that come before all else. And that is giving thanks for what they have and then bringing in this to their deliberations for always the question, how will this affect the seventh generation from now? Roughly 200 years. So this is particularly evident in the ones I know best, both in the Mohawk and the Onondaga, where the leaders are, traditional leaders are strong. And we have brought this into the work, too, the nuclear guardianship work, and in my more widespread work, which is called The Work That Reconnects. and you who are, many of you are coming to the Interdependence Day celebration on July 4th, in the work that we connect, you'll see how we do that. Another way that's been inspiring to me, that's helped, is in the a Buddhist-inspired movement in Sri Lanka called Sarvodaya. And over the last 35 years, I have been closely linked with this movement, which is working to help people at the grassroots take charge of their lives. And a village self-help movement, as they call it. They're active in about 15,000 villages. And they, when I went, that you know, in Sri Lanka has had 30 years of almost 30 years of terrible civil war. And they've developed, I went to a meditation day that they call, and they said, we're going to get 1 million people from both sides, and we bring them to do metta meditation, loving kindness meditation, anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing in and breathing out together. And they came all dressed alike. You couldn't tell whose side of the war they were on. There were Hindu Tamils, and they were fighting with the majority Buddhist Sinhalese. And they didn't have banners distinguishing them. And they had the same beautiful brown skin and straight black hair and white clothes, and they would sit. And at that point, that when I was there, they unveiled a peace plan. Now, it's not the details of the peace plan that I want to call your attention to, but the fact that it was a 500-year peace plan. And in their little pamphlet about it, they said, usually people think they've created peace with the signing of a treaty, but the seeds of the war often go back centuries. The seeds of this civil war go back 500 years to when the colonial powers first came. They were first the Portuguese, then the Dutch, then the British, each for a century and a half. And they said, it's going to take us at least that long to find our true roots of peace in the Dharma and in our respect for each other's traditions. And so then they laid it out, what they hoped could happen in 10 years, what they hoped could happen in 50 years. And then this periods of time became much wider as you got forward into the 500 years. But the fact that they looked at what they were undertaking as something that would bring them in cooperation with the future beings, and that you don't have to imagine, you have to get it done all at once. Just relaxes the rib cage. I want to close with a poem that I love that calls us our task here, puts it in terms, has the same effect on me. It's 1,000 years of healing. As whatever we're doing for the great turning, whatever it is, and whether it's working in the food revolution, whether it's working in peace, whether it's working in the nuclear, whether it's working in renewable energy, but to realize that we don't have to do it overnight, because then we don't really believe we can do it overnight. But we can start firmly with time, a sense of time on our side. Here's the poem. 1,000 years of healing. From whence my hope I cannot say, except it grows in the cells of my skin, in my envelope of mysteries, it hums. In this sheath, so akin to the surface of the earth, it whispers. Beneath the moaning and dissonance in the world, hope's song grows until I know that with this turning, we put a broken age to rest. We who are alive at such a cusp now usher in 1,000 years of healing. Winged ones and four-leggeds, grasses and mountains and each tree, all the swimming creatures, even we wary two-leggeds, hum and call and create the changing song. We remake our relations. We convert our minds to the earth. In this turning time, we finally learn to chime and blend, attune our voices, sing the vision of the great magic we move within. We begin the new habit, getting up glad for 1,000 years of healing. The new habit, getting up glad for 1,000 years of healing. That's what the figure of the celestial Bodhisattva Jizo calls me to. He's the one that made the great vow when the Buddha wondered, who will be there? Who will take the teachings of the Dharma to the future generations? They may be very difficult circumstances far in the future. How will they hear the Dharma? And Jizo, or Chitigarbha, his other name, he said, I'll do it. He made a great vow, I will not become a Buddha until I bring the Dharma to the future ones. So in each of these ways, I am finding that the great vow of Jizo can be ours as well and help us hugely in our practice. Building that intention, that bodhicitta, that yearning in us, that it comes in our bodies as much as in our minds, of being there, and that life will go on. And that time, if we can see time in this way. So I'm going to close with from the Avatamsaka Sutra. I'm going to read it first, and then you're going to hear it sung. When a bodhisattva attains the 10 wisdoms, she can then perform the 10 universal enterings. What are they? They are... No, it's perfectly clear when you hear the singing. This was set to music at my request by... Nuclear educator and activist who spends a lot of time in Japan. And we have, over the last year and 3 months, been feeling every day our anguish over Fukushima. And particularly, it seems to be growing more intense now with the storage pool hanging so rickety and open to the sky over reactor number 4, and then learning the condition of the contamination, the radioactive isotopes in the bodies of the children, and realizing that this is a teaching of the Flower Garland Sutra too, that if their organs are affected, we now have a world where if one is affected, we all are. We all are. That's the teaching of this. So from the voice is that of Kathleen Sullivan.
When a bodhisattva attains the 10 wisdoms, she can then perform the 10 universal
is that loud enough?
Trains. What are they? To bring all the universes into one hair, and one hair into all the universes, to bring all sentient beings' bodies into one body, and one body into all sentient beings' bodies, to bring in conceivable kalpas into one moment, and one moment into inconceivable kalpas, to bring all the Buddha's dharmas into one dharma, and one dharma into all the Buddha's dharmas, to bring an inconceivable number of places into one place, and one place into an inconceivable number of places, to bring an inconceivable number of organs into one organ, and one organ into an inconceivable number of organs, to bring all organs into one non-organ, and one non-organ into all organs, to make all thoughts into one thought, and one thought into all thoughts, to bring all voices and languages into one voice and language, and one voice and language into all voices and languages, to make all the three times into one time, and one time into all the three times. This is the Supreme Samadhi.
Thank you so much, Joanna. Well, let's close, as we usually do, our Dharma talks with the four Bodhisattva vows. So those of you who know it, we'll chant those three times.
Beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible.